Oppressed by the dark and the whispering trees, I didn't speak until we had crossed the brook again. Still damp from the previous immersion, I didn't bother removing my stockings, but sloshed across regardless. Jamie, still dry, stayed that way by leaping from the bank to a central boulder that stood above the current, then vaulted to my bank like a broad jumper. "Have you any idea how dangerous it is to be out alone at night like that, Sassenach?" he inquired. He didn't seem angry, just curious. "No. I mean, yes. I'm sorry if I worried you, but I couldn't leave a child out there. I just couldn't."
"Aye, I know."
He hugged me briefly.
"You've a kind heart, Sassenach. But you've no idea what you're dealing with here."
"Fairies, hm?" I was tired and disturbed over the incident, but covered it with flippancy. "I'm not afraid of superstitions." A thought struck me. "Do you believe in fairies and changelings and all that?" He hesitated for a moment before answering.
"No. No. I dinna believe in such things. Though damned if I'd care to sleep all night on a fairy's hill for all that. But I'm an educated man, Sassenach. I had a German tutor at Dougal's house, a good one, who taught me Latin and Greek and such. And later, when I went to France at 18, well, I studied history and philosophy, and I saw that there was a good deal more to the world than the glens and the moors and the water horses in the lochs. But these people..."
He waved an arm, taking in the darkness behind us.
"They've ne'er been more than a day's walk from the place they were born, except for a great thing like a clan gathering, and that might happen twice in a lifetime. They live among the glens and the lochs, and they hear no more of the world than what Father Bain tells them in Kirk of a Sunday. That, and the old stories."
He held aside an alder branch, and I stooped under it. We were on the deer trail Geely and I had followed earlier, and I was heartened by this fresh evidence that he could find his way, even in the dark. Away from the fairy's hill, he spoke in his normal voice, only pausing occasionally to brush away some tangling growth from his path.
"Those tales are naught but entertainment in Gwilyn's hands when you sit in the hall drinking Rhenish wine."
He preceded me down the path, and his voice floated back to me, soft and emphatic in the cool night air.
"Out here, though, and even in the village, nay, that's something else. Folk live by them. I suppose there's some truth behind some of them."
I thought of the amber eyes of the water horse, and wondered which others were true.
"And others? Well..."
His voice grew softer, and I had to strain to hear him.
"For the parents of that child, maybe it will ease them a bit to believe it is the changeling who died, and think of their own child, healthy and well, living forever with the fairies."
We reached the horses then, and within half an hour the lights of Castle Leoch shone through the darkness to welcome us. I had never thought I would consider that bleak edifice an outpost of advanced civilization, but just now the lights seemed those of a beacon of enlightenment. It wasn't until we drew closer that I realized the impression of light was due to the string of lanterns blazing along the parapet of the bridge. "Something's happened," I said, turning to Jamie. And seeing him for the first time in the light, I realized that he wasn't wearing his usual worn shirt and grubby kilt. His snowy linen shone in the lantern light, and his best, his only, velvet coat lay across the saddle.
"Aye," he nodded, "that's why I came to get you. The Duke's come at last."
The Duke was something of a surprise. I don't know quite what I'd been expecting, but it wasn't the bluff, hearty, red-faced sportsman I met in Leoch's Hall. He had a pleasantly blunt, weather-beaten face, with light blue eyes that always squinted slightly, as though looking into the sun after the flight of a pheasant. I wondered for a moment whether that earlier bit of theatrics regarding the Duke might have been overstated. Looking around the hall, though, I noticed that every boy under 18 wore a slightly wary expression, keeping his eyes fixed on the Duke as he laughed and talked animatedly with Colum and Dougal. Not merely theatrics, then. They had been warned. When I was presented to the Duke, I had some difficulty in keeping a straight face. He was a big man, fit and solid, the sort you so often see booming out their opinions in pubs, bearing down the opposition by dint of loudness and repetition. I had been warned, of course, by Jamie's story, but the physical impression was so overwhelming that when the Duke bowed low over my hand and said, "But how charming to find a countrywoman in this remote spot, mistress," in a voice like an overwrought mouse, I had to bite the inside of my cheek to keep from disgracing myself in public. Worn out from travel, the Duke and his party retired early to bed. The next night, though, there was music and conversation after dinner, and Jamie and I joined Colum, Dougal, and the Duke. Sandringham grew expansive over Colum's Rhenish wine and talked volubly, expounding equally upon the horrors of travel in the Highlands and the beauties of the countryside. We listened politely, and I tried not to catch Jamie's eye as the Duke squeaked out the story of his travails. "Broken axle tree outside of Stirling, and we were becalmed 3 days, in the pouring rain, mind you, before my footman could find a blacksmith to come and repair the blasted thing. And not a half a day later, we bounced into the most tremendous pothole I've ever seen, and broke the damn thing again. And then one horse threw a shoe, and we had to unload the coach and walk beside it, in the mud, and leading the lame nag, and then..." As the tale went on from misfortune to misfortune, I felt an increasing urge to giggle, and attempted to drown it with more wine. Possibly an error in judgment. "But the game, Mackenzie, the game!" the Duke exclaimed at one point, rolling his eyes in ecstasy. "I could scarce believe it. No wonder you set such a table." He gently patted his large, solid stomach. "I swear I'd give my eye teeth for a try at a stag like the one we saw 2 days ago. Splendid beast, simply splendid. Leapt out of the brush right in front of the coach, my dear," he confided to me. "Startled the horses so we near as a toucher went off the road again." Colum raised the bell-shaped decanter with an inquiring cock of one dark brow. As he poured to the proffered glasses, he said, "Well, perhaps we might arrange a hunt for you, Your Grace. My nephew's a bonny huntsman." He glanced sharply from under his brows at Jamie. There was a scarcely perceptible nod in response. Colum sat back, replacing the decanter, and said casually, "Aye, that'll do well, then. Perhaps early next week. It's too early for pheasant, but the stag hunting will be fine." He turned to Dougal, lounging in a padded chair to one side. "My brother might go along, if you have it in mind to travel northwards. He can show you the lands we were discussing earlier."
"Capital, capital!"
The Duke was delighted. He patted Jamie on the leg. I saw the muscles tighten, but Jamie didn't move. He smiled tranquilly, and the Duke let his hand linger just a moment too long. Then His Grace caught my eye on him and smiled jovially at me, his expression saying, "Worth a try, eh?" Despite myself, I smiled back. Much to my surprise, I quite liked the man. In the excitement of the Duke's arrival, I had forgotten Geely's offer to help me discover the sender of the ill wish, and after the unpleasant scene with the changeling child on the Fairies' Hill, I wasn't sure that I wanted to try anything she might suggest. Still, curiosity overcame suspicion. When Colum asked Jamie to ride down and escort the Duncans to the castle for the Duke's banquet 2 days later, I went with him. Thus it was that Thursday found me and Jamie in the Duncans' parlour, being entertained with a sort of awkward friendliness by the fiscal, while his wife finished her dressing upstairs. Largely recovered from the effects of his last gastric attack, Arthur still didn't look terribly healthy. Like many fat men who lose too much weight abruptly, the weight had gone from his face rather than his stomach. His paunch still swelled the green silk of his waistcoat, while the skin of his face drooped in flabby folds. Perhaps I could slip upstairs and help Gilly with her hair or something, I suggested. I've brought her a new ribbon. Foreseeing the possible need of an excuse for talking to Gilly alone, I had brought a small package with me. Producing it as an excuse, I was through the door and up the stairs before Arthur could protest. She was ready for me. "Come on," she said. "We'll go up to my private room for this. We'll have to hurry, but it won't take too long." I followed Gilly up the narrow, twisting stair. The steps were irregular heights. Some of the risers were so high I had to lift my skirts to avoid tripping on the way up. I concluded that 17th century carpenters either had faulty methods of measuring or rich senses of humour. Gilly's private sanctum was at the top of the house, in one of the remote attics above the servants' quarters. It was guarded by a locked door, opened by a truly formidable key that Gilly produced from her apron pocket. It must have been at least 6 inches long, with a broad fretwork head ornamented with a vine and flower pattern. The key must have weighed nearly a pound. Held by the barrel, it would have made a good weapon. Both lock and hinges were well oiled, and the thick door swung inward silently. The attic room was small, cramped by the gabled dormers that cut across the front of the house. Shelves lined every inch of wall space, holding jars, bottles, flasks, vials, and beakers. Bunches of drying herbs, carefully tied with threads of different colours, hung neatly in rows from the rafters overhead, brushing my hair with a fragrant dust as we passed beneath. This was nothing like the clean, business-like order of the herb room downstairs, though. It was crowded, almost cluttered, and dark in spite of the dormer windows. One shelf held books, mostly old and crumbling, the spines unmarked. I ran a curious finger over the row of leather bindings. Most were calf, but there were two or three bound in something different, something soft but unpleasantly oily to the touch, and one that to all appearances was bound in fish skin. I pulled a volume out and opened it gingerly. It was handwritten in a mixture of archaic French and even more obsolete Latin, but I could make out the title, Le Grimoire du Leconte Saint-Germain. I closed the book and set it back on the shelf, feeling a slight shock. A grimoire? A handbook of magic? I could feel Gilly's gaze boring into my back, and turned to meet a mixture of mischief and wary speculation. What would I do, now that I knew? "So it isn't a rumour, then, is it?" I said, smiling. "You really are a witch." I wondered just how far it went, and whether she believed it herself, or whether these were merely the trappings of an elaborate make-believe that she used to alleviate the boredom of marriage to Arthur. I also wondered just what sort of magic she practiced, or thought she practiced. "Oh, white," she said, grinning. "Definitely white magic." I thought ruefully that Jamie must be right about my face. Everyone seemed to be able to tell what I was thinking. "Well, that's good," I said. "I'm really not much of a one for dancing round bonfires at midnight and riding brooms, let alone kissing the devil's ass." Gilly tossed back her hair and laughed delightedly. "You don't kiss anyone's much that I can see," she said. "Nor do I, though if I had a sweet, fiery devil like yours in my bed. I'll not say I might not come to it in time." "That reminds me," I began, but she had already turned away and was about her preparations, murmuring to herself. Checking first to see that the door was securely locked behind us, Gilly crossed to the gabled window and rummaged in a chest built into the window seat. She pulled out a large shallow pan and a tall white candle stuck in a pottery holder. A further foray produced a worn quilt, which she spread on the floor as protection against dust and splinters. "What exactly is it you're planning to do, Gilly?" I asked, examining the preparation suspiciously. Offhand, I couldn't see much sinister intent in a pan, a candle, and a quilt. But then,
I was a novice magician, to say the least. Summoning, she said, tugging the corners of the quilt around so that the sides lay straight with the boards of the floor. Summoning whom? I asked. Or what? She stood and brushed her hair back. Baby fine and slippery, it was coming down from its fastenings. Muttering, she yanked the pins from her hair and let it fall down in a straight, shiny curtain, the colour of heavy cream. Oh, ghosts, spirits, visions, anything you might have need of, she said. A start's the same in any case, but the herbs and the words are different for each thing. What we want now is a vision, to see who it is who's ill-wished ye. Then we can turn the ill-wish back upon them. Well, I really had no wish to be vindictive, but I was curious, both to see what summoning was like, and to know who had left me the ill-wish. Setting the pan in the middle of the quilt, she poured water into it from a jug, explaining, "You can use any vessel big enough to make a good reflection, though the grimoire says to use a silver bassin. Even a pond or a puddle of water outside will do for some kinds of summoning, though it must be secluded. You need peace and quiet to do this." She passed rapidly from window to window, drawing the heavy black curtains until virtually all the light in the room was extinguished. I could barely see Geely's slender form flitting through the gloom until she lit the candle. The wavering flame lit her face as she carried it back to the quilt, throwing wedge-shaped shadows under the bold nose and chiselled jaw. She set the candle next to the pan of water, on the side away from me. She filled the pan very carefully, so full that the water bulged slightly above the rim, kept from spilling by its surface tension. Leaning over, I could see that the surface of the water provided an excellent reflection, far better than that obtainable in any of the castle's looking-glasses. As though mind-reading again, Geely explained that in addition to its use in summoning spirits, the reflecting pan was an excellent accessory for dressing the hair. "Don't bump into it or you'll get soaked," she advised, frowning in concentration as she lit the candle. Something about the practical tone of the remark, so prosaic in the midst of these supernatural preparations, reminded me of someone. Looking up at the slender, pallid figure stooping elegantly over the tinderbox, I couldn't think at first of whom she reminded me. But of course, while no one could be less like that dowdy figure athwart the teapot in Reverend Wakefield's study, the tone of voice had been that of Mrs. Graham exactly. Perhaps it was an attitude they shared, a pragmatism that regarded the occult as merely a collection of phenomena, like the weather. Something to be approached with cautious respect, of course, much as one would take care in using a sharp kitchen knife, but certainly nothing to avoid or fear. Or it might have been the smell of lavender water. Geely's loose, flowing gown smelled always of the essences she distilled. Marigold, chamomile, bay leaf, spikenard, mint, marjoram. Today, though, it was lavender that drifted from the folds of the white dress, the same scent that permeated Mrs. Graham's practical blue cotton and wafted from the corrugations of her bony chest. If Geely's chest was likewise underlaid by such skeletal supports, there was no hint of it visible, in spite of her robe's low neckline. It was the first time I had seen Geely Duncan en déshabillé. Customarily, she wore the severe and voluminous gowns, buttoned high at the neck, that was suitable to the wife of a fiscal. The swelling opulence now revealed was a surprise. A creamy abundance, almost the same shade as the dress she wore, and gave me some idea why a man like Arthur Duncan might have married a penniless girl of no family. My eye went involuntarily to the line of neatly labelled jars along the wall, looking for saltpeter. Geely selected three of the jars from the shelf, pouring a small quantity from each into the bowl of a tiny metal brazier.
She lit the layer of charcoal underneath from the candle flame and blew on the dawning flame to encourage it. A fragrant smoke began to rise as the spark took hold. The air in the attic was so still that the greyish smoke rose straight up without diffusing, forming a column that echoed the shape of the tall white candle. Geely sat between the two columns like a priestess in her temple, legs folded gracefully under her.
"Well, then, that will do nicely, I think."
Briskly dusting crumbs of rosemary from her fingers, Geely surveyed the scene with satisfaction. The black drapes, with their mystic symbols, shut out all intrusive beams of sunlight and left the candle as the only source of direct illumination. The flame was reflected and diffused through the pan of still water, which seemed to glow as though it too were a source rather than a reflection of light.
"What now?" I inquired.
The large grey eyes glowed like the water, alight with anticipation. She waved her hands across the surface of the water, then folded them between her legs.
"Just sit quiet for a moment," she said. "Listen to your heartbeat. Do you hear it? Breathe easy, slow, and deep."
In spite of the liveliness of her expression, her voice was calm and slow, a distinct contrast to her usual sprightly conversation. I obediently did as she instructed, feeling my heart slow as my breathing steadied to an even rhythm. I recognized the scent of rosemary in the smoke, but I wasn't sure of the other two herbs. Foxglove, perhaps, or cinquefoil. I had thought the purple flowers were those of nightshade, but surely that couldn't be. Whatever they were, the slowness of my breathing didn't seem to be attributable only to the power of Geely's suggestion. I felt as though a weight were pressing against my breastbone, slowing my breathing without my having to will it. Geely herself sat perfectly still, watching me with unblinking eyes. She nodded once, and I looked down obediently into the still surface of the water. She began to talk in an even conversational way that reminded me again of Mrs. Graham calling down the sun in the circle of stones. The words were not English, and yet not quite not English either. It was a strange tongue, but one I felt that I should know, as though the words were spoken just below the level of my hearing. I felt my hands begin to go numb, and wanted to move them from their folded position in my lap, but they wouldn't move. Her even voice went on, soft and persuading. Now I knew that I understood what was being said, but still could not summon the words to the surface of my mind. I realized dimly that I was either being hypnotized or under the influence of some drug, and my mind took some last foothold on the edge of conscious thought, resisting the pull of the sweet-scented smoke. I could see my reflection in the water, pupils shrunk to pinpoints, eyes wide as a sun-blind owl's. The word opium drifted through my fading thoughts. "Who are you?" I couldn't tell which of us had asked the question, but I felt my own throat move as I answered, "Claire, who sent you here?"
"I came."
"Why did you come?"
"I can't tell."
"Why can't you tell?"
"Because no one will believe me."
The voice in my head grew still more soothing, friendly, beguiling.
"I will believe you. Believe me."
"Who are you?"
"Claire."
A sudden loud noise broke the spell. Geely started, and her knee bumped the basin, startling the reflection back into the water.
"Gilles, my dear,"
a voice called through the door, tentative yet commanding.
"We must be going, my dear. The horses are ready, and you're not yet gowned."
Muttering something rude under her breath, Geely rose and flung open the window so that the fresh air rushed into my face, making me blink and dispelling some of the fog in my head. She stood looking down at me speculatively, then stooped to help me up.
"Come along, then," she said. "Come over a bit queer, have you? Sometimes it takes folk that way. You'd best lie down on my bed while I dress." I lay flat on the coverlet in her bedroom below, eyes closed, listening to the small rustling noises Geely made in her privy closet, wondering what the hell that had been all about. Nothing to do with the ill-wish or its sender, clearly. Only with my identity. With sharpness returning gradually to my wits, it occurred to me to wonder whether Geely perhaps was a spy for Colum. Placed as she was, she heard the business and the secrets of the whole district. And who, other than Colum, would be so interested in my origins? What would have happened, I wondered, had Arthur not interrupted the summoning? Would I have heard, somewhere in the scented fog, the standard hypnotist's injunction, "When you awake, you will remember nothing"? But I did remember, and I wondered. In the event, however, there was no chance to ask Geely about it. The bedroom door flew open, and Arthur Duncan came in. Crossing to the door of the privy closet, he knocked once, hastily, and went in. There was a small, startled scream from within, and then dead silence. Arthur Duncan reappeared in the door, eyes wide and staring blind, face so white that I thought perhaps he was suffering an attack of some sort. I leapt to my feet and hurried toward him as he leaned heavily against the door jamb. Before I reached him, though, he pushed himself away from the door and went out of the room, staggering slightly, pushing past me as though he didn't see me. I knocked on the door myself. "Geely, are you all right?" There was a moment's silence. Then a perfectly composed voice said, "Aye, of course. I'll be out in a moment." When we at length descended the stairs, we found Arthur, apparently somewhat recovered, sipping brandy with Jamie. He seemed a bit abstracted, as though he were thinking of something, but greeted his wife with a mild compliment on her appearance before sending the groom for the horses. The banquet was just beginning as we arrived, and the fiscal and his wife were shown to their places of honour at the head table. Jamie and I, somewhat lower in status, took our places at a table with Rupert and Ned Gowan. Mrs. Fitz had surpassed herself, and beamed in gratification at the compliments heaped upon the food, the drink, and other preparations. It was, in fact, delicious. I had never tasted roast pheasant stuffed with honeyed chestnuts, and was helping myself to a third slice, when Ned Gowan, watching in some amusement at my appetite, asked whether I had yet tried the suckling pig. My reply was interrupted by a stir at the far end of the hall. Colum had risen from his table and was headed toward me, accompanied by old Alec McMahon.
"I see there's no end to your talents, Mistress Fraser," Colum remarked, bowing slightly. A broad smile marked the arresting features. "From dressing wounds and healing the sick to delivering falls. We shall be calling upon you to raise the dead before long, I suppose."
There was a general chuckle at this, though I noticed one or two men glancing nervously in the direction of Father Bain, in attendance this evening, who was methodically stuffing himself with roast mutton in the corner.
"In any case," Colum continued, reaching into his coat pocket, "you must allow me to present you with a small token of my gratitude."
He handed me a small wooden box, lid carved with the Mackenzie badge. I hadn't realised just how valuable a horse Losgarn was, and mentally thanked whatever benign spirits presided over such events that nothing had gone wrong.
"Nonsense," I said, trying to give it back. "I didn't do anything out of the way. It was only luck that I have small hands."
"Nevertheless,"
Colum was firm,
"if you prefer, consider it a small wedding gift, but I wish you to have it."
At a nod from Jamie, I reluctantly accepted the box and opened it. It contained a beautiful rosary of jet, each bead intricately carved, and the crucifix inlaid with silver. "It's lovely," I said sincerely. And it was, though I had no notion what I might do with it.
Though nominally a Catholic, I had been raised by Uncle Lamb, the completest of agnostics, and had only the vaguest idea of the significance of a rosary. Nonetheless, I thanked Colum warmly, and gave the rosary to Jamie to keep for me in his sporran. I curtsied to Colum, gratified to find that I was mastering the art of doing so without falling on my face. He opened his mouth to take a gracious leave, but was interrupted by a sudden crash that came from behind me. Turning, I could see nothing but backs and heads as people leapt from their benches to gather round whatever had caused the uproar. Colum made his way with some difficulty around the table, clearing aside the crowd with an impatient wave of the hand. As people stepped respectfully out of his way, I could see the rotund form of Arthur Duncan on the floor, limbs flailing convulsively, batting away the helpful hands of would-be assistants. His wife pushed her way through the muttering throng, dropped to the floor beside him, and made a vain attempt to cradle his head in her lap. The stricken man dug his heels into the floor and arched his back, making gargling, choking noises. Glancing up, Geely's green eyes anxiously scanned the crowd as though looking for someone. Assuming that I was the one she was looking for, I took the path of least resistance, dodging under the table and crawling across on hands and knees. Reaching Geely's side, I grabbed her husband's face between my hands and tried to pry his jaws open. I thought from the sounds he was making that he had perhaps choked on a piece of meat which might still be lodged in his windpipe. His jaws were clamped and rigid, though, lips blue and flecked with a foamy spittle that didn't seem consistent with choking. Choking he surely was, though. The plump chest heaved vainly, fighting for breath. "Quickly, turn him on his side," I said. Several hands reached out at once to help, and the heavy body was deftly turned, broad black serge back toward me. I drove the heel of my hand hard between the shoulder blades, smacking him repeatedly with a dull thumping noise. The massive back quivered slightly with the blows, but there was no answering jerk, as of an obstruction suddenly released. I gripped a meaty shoulder and pulled him onto his back once more. Geely bent close over the staring face, calling his name, massaging his mottled throat. The eyes were rolled back now, and the drumming heels began to slacken their beat. The hands, clawed in agony, suddenly flung wide, smacking an anxiously crouching onlooker in the face. The sputtering noises abruptly ceased, and the stout body went limp, lying inert as a sack of barley on the stone flags. I felt frantically for a pulse in one slack wrist, noticing with half an eye that Geely was doing the same, pulling up the round, shaven chin, and pressing her fingertips hard into the flesh under the angle of the jaw, in search of the carotid artery. Both searches were futile. Arthur Duncan's heart, already taxed by the necessity of pumping blood through that massive frame for so many years, had given up the struggle. I tried all the resuscitative techniques at my disposal, useless though I knew them now to be. Arm flapping, chest massage, even mouth-to-mouth breathing, distasteful as that was, but with the expected result. Arthur Duncan was dead as a doornail. I straightened wearily and stood back as Father Bain, with a nasty glare at me, dropped to his knees by the fiscal's side and began hastily to administer the final rites. My back and arms ached, and my face felt oddly numb. The hubbub around me seemed strangely remote, as though a curtain separated me from the crowded hall. I closed my eyes and rubbed a hand across my tingling lips, trying to erase the taste of death. Despite the death of the fiscal and the subsequent formalities of obsequies and burial, the Duke's stag hunt was delayed by no more than a week. The realization of Jamie's imminent departure was deeply depressing. I suddenly realized just how much I looked forward to seeing him at dinner after the day's work. How my heart would leap when I saw him unexpectedly at odd moments during the day, and how much I depended on his company and his solid, reassuring presence amid the complexities of life in the castle.
And to be perfectly honest, how much I like the smooth, warm strength of him in my bed each night. And waking to his tousled, smiling kisses in the mornings. The prospect of his absence was bleak. He held me closely, my head snuggled under his chin. "I'll miss you, Jamie," I said softly. He hugged me tighter and gave a rueful chuckle.
"So I, Sasnach. I hadn't expected it, to tell the truth. But it will hurt me to leave you."
He stroked my back gently, fingers tracing the bumps of the vertebrae. "Jamie, you'll be careful." I could feel the deep rumble of amusement in his chest as he answered.
"Of the Duke or the horse?"
He was, much to my apprehension, intending to ride Donus on the stag hunt. I had visions of the huge sorrel beast plunging over a cliff out of sheer wrong-headedness, or trampling Jamie under those lethal hooves.
"Both," I said dryly. "If the horse throws you and you break a leg, you'll be at the Duke's mercy."
"True. Dougal will be there, though."
I snorted.
"He'll break the other leg."
He laughed and bent to kiss me.
"I'll be careful, Madonna. Will you give me the same promise?"
"Yes," I said, meaning it. "Do you mean whoever left the ill wish?" The momentary amusement was gone now.
"Perhaps. I dinna think you're in any danger or I wouldna leave you.
But still..."
"Oh, and stay away from Gilas Duncan."
"What? Why?" I drew back a little to look up at him. It was a dark night, and his face was invisible, but his tone was altogether serious.
"The woman's known as a witch, and the stories about her... Well, they've got a deal worse since her husband died. I dinna want you anywhere near her, Sasnach."
"Do you honestly think she's a witch?" I demanded.
His strong hands cupped my bottom and scooped me in close to him. I put my arms around him, enjoying the feel of his smooth, solid torso.
"No," he said finally, "but it isna what I think that could be a danger to you. Will you promise?"
"All right." In truth, I had little reluctance to give the promise. Since the incidents of the changeling and the summoning, I hadn't felt much desire to visit Geely. I put my mouth on Jamie's nipple, flicking it lightly with my tongue. He made a small sound deep in his throat and pulled me nearer.
"Open your legs," he whispered. "I mean to be sure you'll remember me while I'm gone."
Sometime later, I woke feeling cold. Groping sleepily for the quilt, I couldn't find it. Suddenly, it came up over me of its own accord. Surprised, I raised up on one elbow to look.
"I'm sorry," Jamie said. "I didn't mean to wake you, lass."
"What are you doing? Why are you awake?"
I squinted over my shoulder at him. It was still dark, but my eyes were so accustomed that I could see the faintly sheepish expression on his face. He was wide awake, sitting on a stool by the side of the bed, his plaid flung around him for warmth.
"It's only... well, I dreamed you were lost, and I couldn't find you. It woke me, and I wanted to look at you, is all. To fix you in my mind, to remember while I'm gone. I turned back the quilt. I'm sorry you were chilled."
"It's all right."
The night was cold and very quiet, as though we were the only two souls in the world. "Come into bed. You must be chilled, too." He slid in next to me and curled himself against my back. His hands stroked me from neck to shoulder, waist to hip, tracing the lines of my back, the curves of my body.
"Madonna," he said softly, "but now I should say, my Eregadach, my silver one. Your hair is silver gilt and your skin is white velvet. Calamangeel, white dove."
I pressed my hips back against him, inviting, and settled against him with a sigh as his solid hardness filled me.
He held me against his chest and moved with me, slowly, deeply.
I gasped a little, and he slackened his hold.
"I'm sorry," he murmured. "I didn't mean to hurt you. But I do want to be in you, to stay in you so deep. I want to leave the feel of me deep inside you with my seed. I want to hold you so and stay with you till dawn and leave you sleeping and go, with the shapes of you warm in my hands."
I pressed firmly back against him.
"You won't hurt me."
After Jamie's departure, I moped about the castle. I saw patients in the surgery. I occupied myself as much as I could in the gardens, and I tried to distract myself by browsing in Colum's library, but still time hung heavy on my hands. I had been alone nearly 2 weeks when I met the girl Leah in the corridor outside the kitchens. I had watched her covertly now and then since the day when I had seen her on the landing outside Colum's study. She seemed blooming enough, but there was an air of tenseness about her that was easily discernible. She seemed distracted and moody. "A little wonder, poor girl," I thought kindly. Today, though, she looked somewhat excited. "Mrs. Fraser," she said, "I've a message for you." The Widow Duncan, she said, had sent word that she was ill and requested me to come and tend her. I hesitated, remembering Jamie's injunctions, but the twin forces of compassion and boredom were sufficient to set me on the road to the village within the hour, my medicine box strapped behind me on the horse's saddle. The Duncan's house, when I arrived, had an air of neglected abandon, a sense of disorder that extended through the house itself. There was no answer to my knock, and when I pushed the door open, I found the entry hall and parlour scattered with books and dirty glasses, mats askew and dust thick on the furniture. My calls produced no maidservant, and the kitchen proved to be as empty and disordered as the rest of the house. Increasingly anxious, I went upstairs. The bedroom in front also was vacant, but I heard a faint shuffling noise from the still-room across the landing. Pushing open the door, I saw Gilly sitting in a comfortable chair, feet propped on the counter. She had been drinking. There was a glass and decanter on the counter, and the room smelled strongly of brandy. She was startled to see me, but struggled to her feet, smiling. Her eyes were slightly out of focus, I thought, but she certainly seemed well enough. "What's the matter?" I asked. "Aren't you ill?" She goggled at me in amazement.
"Ill? Me?"
"No. The servants have all left, and there's no food in the house, but there's plenty of brandy. Will you have a drop?"
She turned back toward the decanter. I grabbed her sleeve. "You didn't send for me?"
"No."
She stared at me, wide-eyed. "Then why..." My question was interrupted by a noise from outside, a far-off, rumbling, muttering sort of noise. I had heard it before, from this room, and my palms had grown sweaty then at the thought of confronting the mob that made it. I wiped my hands on the skirts of my dress. The rumbling was nearer, and there was neither need nor time for questions. Chapter 25.
Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live.
The drab-clad shoulders ahead of me parted on darkness. My elbow struck wood with a bone-numbing thump as I was shoved roughly over a threshold of some sort, and I fell headlong into a black stench, alive and wriggling with unseen forms. I shrieked and thrashed, trying to free myself from entanglement with innumerable scrabbling tiny feet, and an attack by something larger that squealed and struck me a hard blow on the thigh. I succeeded in rolling away, though only a foot or two, before I hit an earthen wall that sent a shower of dirt cascading down on my head. I huddled as close to it as I could get, trying to suppress my own gasping breath, so that I could hear whatever was trapped in this reeking pit with me. Whatever it was large and breathing hoarsely, but not growling. A pig, perhaps. "Who's there?" came a voice from the Stygian black, sounding scared but defiantly loud.
"Claire, is it you?"
"Keely," I gasped, and groped toward her, meeting her hands, likewise searching. We clasped each other tightly, rocking slightly back and forth in the gloom. "Is there anything else in here besides us?" I asked, glancing cautiously around. Even with my eyes now accustomed to the dark, there was precious little to be seen. There were faint streaks of light coming from somewhere above, but the tenebrous shadows were shoulder-high here below. I could barely make out Geely's face, level with my own, and only a few inches away. She laughed, a little shakily. "Several mice, I think, and other vermin, and a smell that would knock a ferret over." I noticed the smell. Where in God's name are we? "The thieves' hall. Stand back!" There was a grating sound from overhead, and a sudden shaft of light. I pressed myself against the wall, barely in time to avoid a shower of mud and filth that cascaded through a small opening in the roof of our prison. A single soft plop followed the deluge. Geely bent and picked up something from the floor. The opening above remained, and I could see that what she held was a small loaf, stale and smeared with assorted muck. She dusted it gingerly with a fold of her skirt. "Dinner," she said. "Hungry, are you?" The hole above remained open and empty, save for the occasional missile flung by a passer-by. The drizzle came in, and a searching wind. It was cold, damp, and thoroughly miserable. Suitable, I supposed, for the malefactors it was meant to house. Thieves, vagrants, blasphemers, adulterers, and suspected witches. Geely and I huddled together for warmth against one wall, not speaking much. There was little to say, and precious little either of us could do for ourselves, beyond possess our souls in patience. The hole above grew gradually darker as night came on, until it faded into the black all around. "How long do you think they mean to keep us here?" Geely shifted, stretching her legs so that the small oblong of morning light from above shone on the striped linen of her skirt. Originally a fresh pink and white, it was now considerably the worse for wear. "Not too long," she said. "They'll be waiting for the ecclesiastical examiners. Arthur had letters last month arranging for it. The second week of October it was. They should be here any time." She rubbed her hands together to warm them, then put them on her knees in the little square of sunlight. "Tell me about the examiners," I said. "What will happen exactly?"
"I canna say exactly.
I've ne'er seen a witch trial, though I've heard of them, of course."
She paused a moment, considering.
"They'll not be expecting a witch trial, since they were coming to try some land disputes. So they'll not have a witch pricker, at least."
"A what?"
"Witches canna feel pain," Geely explained. "Nor do they bleed when they're pricked."
The witch pricker, equipped with a variety of pins, lancets, and other pointed implements, was charged with testing for this condition. I vaguely recalled something of this from Frank's books, but had thought it a practice common to the 17th century, not this one. On the other hand, I thought wryly, Cranesmuir was not exactly a hotbed of civilization. "In that case, it's too bad there won't be one," I said, though recoiling slightly at the thought of being stabbed repeatedly. "We could pass that test with no difficulty."
"Or I could," I added caustically. "I imagine they'd get ice water, not blood, when they tried it on you."
"I'd not be too sure," she said reflectively, overlooking the insult. "I've heard of witch prickers with special pins made to collapse when they're pressed against the skin, so it looks as though they don't go in."
"But why? Why try to prove someone a witch on purpose?"
The sun was on the decline now, but the afternoon light was enough to suffuse our hutch with a dim glow. The elegant oval of Geely's face showed only pity for my innocence.
"You still dunna understand, do you?" she said.
"They mean to kill us,"
And it doesn't matter much what the charge is or what the evidence shows. We'll burn all the same.
The night before, I had been too shocked from the mob's attack and the misery of our surroundings to do more than huddle with Geely and wait for the dawn. With the light, though, what remained of my spirit was beginning to awake.
"Why, Geely?" I asked, feeling rather breathless. "Do you know?"
The atmosphere in the hole was thick with the stench of rot, filth, and damp soil, and I felt as though the impenetrable earthen walls were about to cave in upon me like the sides of an ill-dug grave. I felt, rather than saw her, shrug. The shaft of light from above had moved with the sun, and now struck the wall of our prison, leaving us in cold dark below.
"If it's much comfort to you," she said dryly, "I misdoubt you were meant to be taken. It's a matter between me and Colum. You had the ill luck to be with me when the townsfolk came.
Had you been with Colum, you'd likely have been safe enough, Sassenach or no."
The term Sassenach, spoken in its usual derogatory sense, suddenly struck me with a sense of desperate longing for the man who called me so in affection. I wrapped my arms around my body, hugging myself to contain the lonely panic that threatened to envelop me.
"Why did you come to my house?"
Geely asked curiously.
"I thought you had sent for me. One of the girls at the castle brought me a message. From you," she said.
"Ah,"
she said thoughtfully.
"Lear, was it?"
I sat down and rested my back against the earth wall, despite my revulsion for the muddy, stinking surface. Feeling my movement, Geely shifted closer. Friends or enemies, we were each other's only source of warmth in the hole. We huddled together, perforce.
"How did you know it was Lear?" I asked, shivering.
"'Twas her that left the ill wish in your bed," Geely replied. "I told you at the first there were those minded you're taking the red-haired laddie. I suppose she thought if you were gone she'd have a chance at him again."
I was struck dumb at this, and it took a moment to find my voice.
"But she couldn't."
Geely's laughter was hoarsened by cold and thirst, but still held that edge of silver.
"Anyone seeing the way the lad looks at you would know that. But I dinna suppose she's seen enough of the world to ken such things. Let her lie wi' a man once or twice, and she'll know, but not now."
"That's not what I meant," I burst out. "It isn't Jamie she wants. The girl's with child by Dougal Mackenzie."
"What?"
She was genuinely shocked for a moment, and her fingers bit into the flesh of my arm.
"How'd you come to think that?"
I told her of seeing Lair on the stair below Colum's study, and the conclusions I had come to. Geely snorted.
"Pah! She had Colum and Dougal talking about me. That's what made her blench. She'd think Colum had heard she'd been to me for the ill wish. He'd have her whipped to bleeding for that. He doesn't allow any truck with such arts."
"You gave her the ill wish?"
I was staggered. Geely drew herself sharply away at this.
"I didn't give it to her, no. I sold it to her."
I stared, trying to meet her eyes through the gathering darkness.
"There's a difference."
"Of course there is,"
she spoke impatiently.
"It was a matter of business, was all.
And I don't give away my customers' secrets.
Besides, she didn't tell me who it was meant for. And you'll remember that I did try to warn you."
"Thanks," I said with some sarcasm. "But..." My brain was churning, trying to rearrange my ideas in light of this new information. "But if she put the ill wish in my bed, then it was Jamie she wanted. That would explain her sending me to your house. But what about Dougal?" Geely hesitated for a moment, then seemed to come to some decision.
"The girl's no more wee child by Dougal Mackenzie than you are."
"How can you be so sure?"
She groped for my hand in the darkness. Finding it, she drew it close and placed it squarely on the swelling bulge beneath her gown.
"Because I am,"
she said simply. "Not Leia, then," I said.
"You."
"Me." She spoke quite simply, without any of her usual affectation. "What was it Colum said? I'll see that she's done rightly by. Well, I suppose this is his idea of a suitable disposal of the problem." I was silent for a long time, mulling things over. "Geely," I said at last, "that stomach trouble of your husband's." She sighed. "Why, arsenic," she said. "I thought it would finish him before the child began to show too much, but he hung on longer than I thought possible." I remembered the look of mingled horror and realization on Arthur Duncan's face as he burst out of his wife's closet on the last day of his life. "I see," I said. "He didn't know you were with child until he saw you half-dressed the day of the Duke's banquet. And when he found out, I suppose he had good reason to know it wasn't his." There was a faint laugh from the far corner. "The saltpeter came dear, but it was worth every farthing." I shuddered slightly, hunched against the wall. "But that's why you had to risk killing him in public at the banquet. He would have denounced you as an adulteress and a poisoner. Or do you think he realized about the arsenic?" "Oh, Arthur knew," she said. "He wouldn't admit it, to be sure, not even to himself, but he knew. We'd sit across the board from each other at supper, and I'd ask, 'Will you have a bit more of the Cullen skink, my dear?' Or, 'A sup of ale, my own.' And him watching me with those eyes like boiled eggs, and he'd say, 'No, he didn't feel himself with an appetite just then.' And he'd push his plate back, and later I'd hear him in the kitchen, secret-like, gobbling his food, standing by the hutch, thinking himself safe because he ate no food that came from my hand." Her voice was light and amused, as though she had been recounting some bit of juicy gossip. I shuddered again, drawing away from the thing that shared the darkness with me. He didn't guess it was in the tonic he took. He'd take no medicine I made. Ordered a patent tonic from London. Cost the F, too. Her voice was resentful at the extravagance. The stuff had arsenic in it to start. He didn't notice any difference in the taste when I added a bit more. I had always heard that vanity was the besetting weakness of murderers. It seemed this was true, for she went on, ignoring our situation in the pride of recounting her accomplishments. It was a bit risky to kill him before the whole company like that, but I had to manage something quickly. Not arsenic either, to kill like that. I remembered the fiscal's hard blue lips, and the numbness of my own where they had touched him. A quick and deadly poison. And here I had thought that Dougal was confessing to an affair with Leia. But in that case, while Colum might be disapproving, there would have been nothing to prevent Dougal marrying the girl. He was a widower and free. But an adulterous affair with the wife of the fiscal? That was a different kettle of fish for all concerned. I seem to recall that the penalties for adultery were severe. Colum could hardly smooth over an affair of that magnitude. But I couldn't see him condemning his brother to public whipping or banishment. And Geely might well consider murder a reasonable alternative to being burnt on the face with a hot iron and shut up for several years in a prison, pounding hemp for 12 hours a day. So she had taken her preventive measures, and Colum had taken his. And here was I, caught up in the middle. "The child, though," I asked, "surely..." There was a grim chuckle in the blackness. "Accidents happen, my friend, to the best of us. And once it happened..." I felt rather than saw her shrug. I meant to get rid of it. But then I thought it might be a way to make him marry me once Arthur was dead. A horrible suspicion struck me. But Dougal's wife was still alive then. "Gillis, did you..." Her dress rustled as she shook her head, and I caught a faint gleam from her hair.
I meant to, she said, but God saved me the trouble. I rather thought that was a sign, you know.